Blog Talk Radio.
The shock of what happened here 7 days ago has for many county employees turned into the fear that somehow it might happen again. To put the available pieces to this story together, one must go back in time, beginning with last Friday's 34-minute ordeal, recorded by photographers Jim Keene and Roger Bockrath of the San Rafael Independent Journal.
Because that would only continue the oppression and exploitation of oppressed people in the United States, and specifically African people born and raised in the United States. Socialism is an integral part of building social justice on this planet. The condition of my people, my history, was very much connected with other oppressed people, and I began to see that they're the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck. And so I began to understand that imperialism has to go. It is a poison that is killing people all over this world. The priorities of this planet have to be completely changed. And instead of profits, instead of policies that destroy the earth, that destroy the water, that destroy human beings, I believe a policy that protects people, that makes people live in a community, a world community, that's what I believe. That's my basic political commitment at this moment.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food, but he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick." He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away. Let's escape. Let's separate," That house Negro would look at you and say, man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, I'm the only Negro out here. I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You nothing but a house Negro. And if someone come to you right now and say, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts. Our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and because you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw. And you don't know what's happening. Because someone has taught you to suffer peacefully. The white man do the same thing to you in the street. When he gonna want to put knots on your head and take advantage of you and don't have to be afraid of you fighting back. To keep you from fighting back, he get these old religious Uncle Toms to teach you and me that just like Novocaine, suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering, just suffer peacefully. As Reverend Cleve pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And you know he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. Because nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send them to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal. This is the way it is with the white man in America. He's a wolf and you a sheep. Anytime a shepherd, a pastor, teach you and me not to run from the white man and at the same time teachers don't fight the white man, he's a traitor to you and me. Don't lay down our life all by itself. No. Preserve your life. It's the best thing you got. And if you got to give it up, let it be even Stephen. The slave master took Tom and dressed him well and fed him well and even gave him a little education, a little education. Gave him a long coat and a top hat and made all the other slaves look up to him. Then he used Tom to control them. The same strategy that was used in those days is used today by the same white man. He take a Negro, so-called Negro, and make him prominent. Build him up. Publicize him. Make him a celebrity. And then he becomes a spokesman for Negroes and a Negro leader. I would like to just mention one thing else quickly, and that is the method that the white man uses,
how the white man uses these big guns or Negro leaders against the black revolution. They are not a part of the black revolution. They're used against the black revolution. When Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. Plus, even financially, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble, plus it was in trouble, period, with the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders began to stir up our people at the grassroots level. This was never done by these Negroes whom you recognize of national stature. They controlled you, but they never incited you or excited you. They controlled you. They contained you. They kept you on the plantation. As soon as King failed in Birmingham, Negroes took to the streets. King got out and went out to California to a big rally and raised about, I don't know how many thousands of dollars. Come to Detroit and had a march and raised some more thousands of dollars. And recall, right after that, Wilkins attacked King, accused King and the Corps of starting trouble everywhere and then making the NAACP get him out of jail and spend a lot of money, and then he accused King and Corps of raising all the money and not paying it back. This happened. I got it in documented evidence in the newspaper. Roy started attacking King, and King started attacking Roy, and Farmer started attacking both of them. And as these Negroes of national stature begin to attack each other, they begin to lose their control of the Negro masses. And Negroes was out there in the streets. They was talking about, we're going to march on Washington. By the way, and right at that time, Birmingham had exploded, and the Negroes in Birmingham, remember, they also exploded. They began to stab the crackers in the back and bust them upside the head. Yes, they did. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. So, and right after that, Kennedy got on the television and said, this is a moral issue. That's when he said he's going to put out a civil rights bill. And when he mentioned civil rights bill and the Southern crackers started talking about they were going to boycott it or filibuster it, then the Negroes started talking about what? We're going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress and tie it up, bring it to a halt. Don't let the government proceed. They even said they were going to go out to the airport and lay down on the runway and don't let no airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. Scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in Wilkins. They called in Randolph. They called in these national Negro leaders that you respect and told them, call it off. Kennedy said, look, y'all letting this thing go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us. And that old shrewd fox, he said, well, if you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it. A matter of hours went by. They had a meeting at the Carlyle Hotel in New York City. The Carlyle Hotel is owned by the Kennedy family. That's the hotel Kennedy spent the night at two nights ago. Belongs to his family. A philanthropic society headed by a white man named Stephen Currier called all the top civil rights leaders together at the Carlisle Hotel and told them that by you all fighting each other, you're destroying the civil rights movement. And since you're fighting over money from white liberals, let us set up what's known as the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership. Let's form this council, and all the civil rights organizations will belong to it. And we'll use it for fundraising purposes. Let me show you how tricky the white man is. And as soon as they got it formed, they elected Whitney Young as the chairman. And who you think became the co-chairman? Stephen Currier, the white man. A millionaire. Powell was talking about it down at the Cobo today. This is what he was talking about. Powell knows it happened. Randolph knows it happened. Wilkins knows it happened. King knows it happened. Every one of that so-called Big Six, they know what happened. Once they formed it, with the white man over it, he promised them and gave them $800,000 to split up between the Big Six and told them that after the march was over, they'd give them $700,000 more. $1.5 million split up between leaders that you've been following, going to jail for, crying crocodile tears for, and they'd nothing but Frank James and Jesse James and what you call it, brothers. Soon as they got the setup organized, the white man made available to them top public relations experts. Opened the news media across the country at their disposal. And then they began to project these Big Six as the leaders of the march. Originally, they weren't even in the march. You was talking this march talk on Hastings Street. Is Hastings Street still here? On Hastings Street. You was talking the march talk on Lenox Avenue. And down on, Fillmore Street, and Central Avenue, and 42nd Street, and 63rd Street. That's where the march talk was being talked. But the white man put the Big Six ahead of it, made them the march. They became the march. They took it over. And the first move they made after they took it over, they invited Walter Reuther, a white man. They invited a priest. A rabbi and an old white preacher. Yes, an old white preacher. The same white element that put Kennedy in power. Labor, the Catholics, the Jews, and liberal Protestants. Same clique that put Kennedy in power joined the March on Washington. It's just like when you got some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. What you do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. If you pour too much cream in, you won't even know you ever had coffee. It used to be hot, it becomes cool. It used to be strong, it becomes weak. It used to wake you up, now it'll put you to sleep. This is what they did with the March on Washington. They joined it. They didn't integrate it, they infiltrated it. They joined it, became a part of it, took it over. And as they took it over, it lost its militancy. They ceased to be angry. They ceased to be hot. They ceased to be uncompromising. Why, it even ceased to be a march. It became a picnic, a circus. Nothing but a circus with clowns and all. You had one right here in Detroit. I saw it on television with clowns leading it, white clowns and black clowns. I know you don't like what I'm saying, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because I can prove what I'm saying. If you think I'm telling you wrong, you bring me Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and James Farmer and those other three. And see if they'll deny it over the microphone. No, it was a sellout. It was a takeover. When James Baldwin came in from Paris, they wouldn't let him talk. Because they couldn't make him go by the script. Bert Lancaster read the speech that Baldwin was supposed to make. They wouldn't let Baldwin get up there. Because they know Baldwin liable to say anything. They controlled it so tight, they told those Negroes what time to hit town. How to come. Where to stop. What sign to carry. What song to sing. What speech they could make and what speech they couldn't make. And then told them to get out of town by sundown. And every one of those Toms were out of town by sundown. Now, I know you don't like my saying this, but I can back it up. It was a circus, a performance. It beat anything Hollywood could ever do. The performance of the year. Reuther and those other three devils should get a Academy Award for the best actors because they acted like they really loved Negroes and fooled a whole lot of Negroes. And the six Negro leaders should get an award, too, for the best supporting cast.
Enough is enough.
Yeah. Right.
And you are not coming to the people's defense.
That's right, right.
So if you want us to do better, then damn it, you do better. Do what you say. This country is supposed to be about the land of the free for all. It has not been free for black people, and we are tired.
One question, protect and serve who? To me it seems that they just quick to observe you. And then they had the nerve to come and deserve you. Enforce a curfew, they physically hurt you. I heard the patience was a virtue. But how long we gonna disregard the fact is we all talk and practice. This new age, trying to rebuke rage. Or y'all gonna need some skin more tougher than Luke Cage. Trayvon, Terrence, they gone, perished. On up to George Floyd, see what your laws avoid. And now we gotta find some sort of order before the slaughter gets brought up with mortar report.
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Matt Turner, co-host, Brother Motherland, National Minister of Defense, myself, and our engineers on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communication, Sister Amina, calling each and every Tuesday night. Same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, is it democracy or fascism? Continue. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chair, People's Political Party, Nat Turner. All power to the people, Yahuru and black power, comrade. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me, brother?
Yes, sir. Right on.
You hear me?
Black power. Uh-huh. You hear me?
Yeah, we yeah, right on. Black power, pop speak. We as we are getting used to saying from the beginning that, you know, we be having these strange occurrences, you know, on the radio show due to the subject matter, which in some instances may be considered to be a dog-rated in a sense, but from a political perspective. So if any thing that may transpire that may separate us or disconnect us from the show or the people, best believe wasn't coincidence that these forces that's working behind the scene to disrupt the process of political education, politically educating our people, meaning black people, people of African descent, and whatnot, indigenous people, what have you. The system, state makes no differences. They make no distinctions as far as labeling terms and whatnot, you know, names, whatever the case may be. But we believe in the political education process of black people, or descendants of the Africans, the civilized Africans who were brought here by force, by the force of violence or the violence of force, and transformed into a slave society that, you know, built the economic infrastructure of this capital system as part of the world. We can never say that enough, even some cases where some may consider us to be redundant. But at Sprite, McDonald's, and whatnot, Burger King have the slogans that they constantly bombard in people's minds and the people's psyche, so much so that they go on automatic pilot. They know all these hip slogans and fancy pickup lines to get us to consume. And so we believe that if we can take the same approach but from a political education perspective and get our people to understand certain things that is vital to our existence, to our survival in this part of the world, in the United States of America. And we spell, you know, that with three K's. The rest is lowercase letters beginning with the A. And it is not by some strange coincidence or some blind, misguided rage on the part of an angry black man who hates whitey and all that kind of shit there. It's due to experience, which has been nothing but cataclysmic for the past 5 centuries. Some of us may like to start 1619 and whatnot. All this stuff about Plymouth Rock and all this kind of shit in the Mayfly and all that kind of stuff. But the reality is so much more than fancy tales, neatly packaged stories of, you know, people coming here in some great melting pot, you know. That's what makes America great, the different groups that can be here, and that there's somehow some kind of way can work. But the reality is so much more, you know, from the fiction when it comes to the experience of black people in this country. So we continue with what we started last week. Is it democracy or is it fascism? We can never say both of those terms enough. One has nothing to do with the other. They're opposed. They're totally juxtaposed to one another. There are contradictions. And one group of people claim to refer to themselves as being the practitioners or the proprietors or leaders of the free world, so-called democracy, as opposed to those who have labeled other nations' leaders as fascists. And so we want to present some more things and let you decide. And last week we got it certain that we even got around the black people, yeah, I mean to the police and black people particularly. Just the case of got somebody we're gonna
Just so you can like get kinda close to your speaker, because it sounds like the ceiling might be a little low where you're at, and it's like it's bouncing a little bit.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, right on. Is that better? Okay.
Say something?
Okay. Thank you. Better? Testing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we talked about differences that the whites had been having amongst themselves and the issue of women within society. we move over into, a number of things. The rape of Africa, getting into that more. Do democracies create crises? Do democracies create artificial overthrows or revolutions or rebellions or insurrections? Do democracies actually do that, is the question. We would think that since we're told what democracy is, we explained what it was in terms of the basic root definition of a union board for the people, by the people, man, woman, child, union, the community, in definition of itself. Something which had come out of Africa and that the Greeks had copied.
Black Power.
Okay. It's bad.
Yeah, you going? You probably gonna, you got to move from where you're at.
Okay.
Like it'll be straight first, and then it'll start bouncing back again.
Okay, how's that? Is that better?
There you go. Way better.
Okay, right on. You know, the question is, again, you know, do democracies attack other countries' economies, countries, currencies? You know, is that democracy? If we were living in a democracy, then why would those who say that we live in a democracy would do such things? And so America has had a history of creating these artificial crises, which makes it look like on the surface that people are coming from poorer countries, people are coming from countries where there's mayhem, you know, violence and, you know, low food and whatnot. You know, this thing about a government that has been come unglued. This is documented. I can't make this shit up. You know what I'm saying? And we let you decide. We believe that if we had lived in a democracy, then that democracy would not only be side by side with other countries who practice a way of life that has been consistent for them, that has kept cohesion intact, living under a culture and a particular type of system that they've always lived under. We believe that we can live. Would be able to live next to these other countries in a humanistic relationship with them. But that seems to have not been the case historically with this government in relation to other countries. These terminologies that they use as state actors, we hardly understand such knowledge, such terminologies or the knowledge of it as a state actor. You know what I'm saying? What they basically mean is when they set up the so-called UN, okay, they set up the UN and to put themselves in a privileged position. But the UN was set up after World War II. World War II, just like World War I, was basically a division or dividing of the habitable part of the earth amongst the nations involved in this war, in these wars, you know, the opposing sides. And one would appear to have been democracy as opposed on the other side that made up this terminology that referred to as the axis of evil. That would be the Italians, the Japanese, and the Germans. But the strangest thing about all of that is after World War II, the same countries that had been referred to as the enemy, the evil axis, had become friends, had become so much friends that they joined these quasi-secret clandestine organizations, had become friends with them overnight, which tells you that World War II was so much more bigger than quote-unquote stopping Hitler. It was about a game of chess, who could accumulate the most colonies, who can accumulate the most capital amongst themselves. This is why the Japanese, the Italians, and the Germans had soon become friends. The Japanese is part of a very, very, very seldomly known group referred to as the Trilateral Commission. The Trilateral Commission began in the early 70s by some architects who could care less on what side that they were on. It was all about dominating the earth and dominating the natural resources of what they were considered to be poorer nations who were not in a position to defend themselves. So the question is, do democracies do such things? You know, or are we supposed to ignore that part of the history of the relationship of this government with other nations and just say, well, as long as we can vote, but as long as we don't share and control and dictate the power and which way that power is supposed to be angled, what direction and whatnot,
the people's money, the taxpayers, whose money is collected from them illegally. Some of us have no clue that the graduated income tax was an illegal operation, that it hadn't gone through the necessary process of this voting thing, you know, this process that it goes through and it comes into law. There are very few people who are conscious of that who have challenged this corporation in the courts, in the Supreme Court, as being illegally detained for an illegal act upon them by the government or a wing of the government. The IRS is one of the biggest mobs, cartels in this world. But to give you an example, not that it's new, in 1973, this government hatched a plan to assassinate Salvador Allende, who had become the democratically elected president of the country of Chile, a South American country. Now, the people practiced the same democracy that they've been practicing here. The people voted in the person that that they chose or that they felt was best fit for them and for the nation. And before too long, this democratic government overthrew that democratic government. Now the question is again, is it democracy or is it fascism? Why would a democracy, so-called democracy, this government, overthrow another democracy? Can also be the question. If anybody who's listening would like to take a stab at that question, feel free to do so by pressing the one on your phone and enter the question comment. It is what it is. And again, these are just things that we want to point out and leave to the listening audience to try to figure out what really is democracy. And so they overthrew that government using their agents inside of the country to basically take over the government, take over the presidential palace, and murder Salvador Allende. Now, some may ask the question, what would have been the cause? What would have been the reason? Now, one of the things that he did was the corporations that had been in Chile, American corporations, right? And as the CEO of that country, the leader, what he chose to do was what's called nationalize the foreign companies that were on their soil. To nationalize the foreign companies that were on their soil means this. When you nationalize the foreign companies, that means the money that's accumulated on a part of that corporation that they have to pay rent, okay, would trickle down to the population. You know, the people would get a cut of that. And this is what Allende, some people, you know, pronounce it Allende, of course, it's spelled A-L-L-E-N-D-E. And so that's what he did. And, you know, is that democracy? You know, did what he do, is that democracy? You know, the sharing of the wealth from these rich corporations that had moved in and had set up shop and had been, having themselves a good time exploiting the natural resources in that part of the world. And so that's what he did. That's what you call nationalizing these corporations, which means nation profit, not in the hands of a few people that we have here, which is actually what takes place here in America, where a few people accumulate the bulk of the wealth, and they met out a certain percentage to those who they exploit in terms of their labor. So the question is that democracy, the few or the many? And if it's not democracy, then what it appears to have been fascism. Again, the explanation of fascism, the definition of fascism, had Benito Mussolini, who said that he was proud to be a fascist, had explained simply a combination or a joining or a merging between government and the corporations, and they get together and they run shit. Some of the well-meaning whites who have decided to step forward and try to, educate the people here in this country, the dumbed-down masses of the population. And I really don't like to use that word, dumb. I don't believe people are necessarily dumb just, out of the blue. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, some of these good white folks, the so-called good whites, who tried to expose these rotten, evil, treacherous mechanisms that run things, when we refer to as the state, the politician, the businessman, the judge, and the police who work hand in glove to keep the structure intact, white male patriarchal rule. But they refer to it as a plutocracy, Pluto being the smallest of the nine planets. So that's where that word comes from, or corporatocracy, meaning the corporations, and they run, the show. And so it's an array of things, those who lobby on behalf of the corporations when it's voting time, the politicians on the left and the right. I want to mention here with that. Xavier University, Louisiana, referred to as a black university, a black college, what have you. But it's really a Catholic-controlled educational set. And their former president named Norman Francis, there was this gathering of these black intellectuals after what we refer to as Hurricane America, that the general mass of the population knows as Hurricane Katrina. And there was this gathering at this place, where the blacks were stranded and left to die in what was called the convention center in the CBD, big old huge area. And so it was Tavis Smiley, some other folks that have this annual thing every year, and they would get all of these, these big shots, these big intellectuals, Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson, and all these other persons that they would invite to sit on the stage on various panels and stuff. They would discuss, the various things, putting on one heck of a show. Even Dick Gregory, I believe, was appeared at this event. But Norman Francis, the president, was on one of these panels, and he had been speaking to the young people. And this is around the time when Obama was running for president. He was on this panel. He was talking about, giving the youth, the right information and whatnot, so forth, right? And so when that panel was over, me and some comrades, went to peep out this this show, this grandstanding. We had seen at some point Norman Francis out in what would be like the foyer area, near the, at the time he used to have, I guess, like the payphones, a little up, up against the wall. And so we approached him, and we had information on both sides, all the candidates who had been running as Democrats and the other sides who had been running as Republicans. And it just so happened to be, these campaign contributions is public information. And we don't believe that too many of our people may have been doing same or similar homework. But we had approached him, and I, taken, the lead in speaking with him. And I had showed him the campaign contributions, Obama on one side, Hillary Clinton on one side, and McCain on the other side, and all the other individuals. And what you see is the same corporations, even banks, the banking entities, had made contributions on both sides, and so much so that even a German bank, the Deutsche Bank, is a German bank, and this bank had made campaign contributions to both Obama and John McCain. And it struck me because Norman Francis had said again about giving the youth, the young people, the right information. And so I had, you know, this paper, and I turned the pages, you know, one at a time, and showed him the list of campaign contributors on both sides. And I pointed out the same entities. There were several entities that had made campaign contributions to McCain and Obama, and even Hillary Clinton. And so I asked him, you know, what do you make of this? You know, what, and what he did was, he had said that OLC, we don't want to worry about this, you know. And so he, you know, he's kindly sliding the paper to the side, and I had to reiterate, I had to bring the paper back up and say, yes, we do need to worry about this, because we need to know who is working behind the scenes, and how could, if I go for a Democrat and somebody else votes for a Republican, that one of us has to lose, whereas this bank wins either way it goes, you see. And so this is the type of ridiculousness that has been going on within the black population. Now, there are those who have their favorites. There are those, you know, it may be somebody's on here listening that went to the University of Xavier during the time when he was president and whatnot, and may be fond of him, think the world of him. But it's not no personal thing. This is not some personal self-aggrandizing. It is about the people. And it's no more, no less than that. And we all are part of the people. But everybody who was part of the people haven't actually been with the people. Let me say that again. We all are part of the people. But everybody who's part of the people ain't necessarily been with the people. There's been people who have been operating in our midst. And so the question is that democracy or is it fascism? We'll let you decide. And so the voting thing, how could a foreign entity not lose, but if the Democratic person wins, the Republicans lose, which is what happened. Obama won, which means all the Republican voters have lost. But yet this same banking entity could not lose either way it goes. Now, do democracies operate like that? Is that what we're supposed to believe? That's how a democracy actually works. And so it is simple. It's not actually difficult. It's not actually some hard, incredible thing to understand. I think the problem is that we have been so entertained so much by sports and, you know, music events and festivals and, you know, the various things that draw our visual arousals. You know, you have visual arousal and, of course, sensual arousal. But that has been the kryptonite that has kept the people in a dumbed-down state. Okay, like I said, not something that just rose up, just jumped up out of the sea, just came out of nowhere, or just out of the blue. You know, Bill Clinton himself had once said that nothing happens by coincidence, you see. And so what Allende did, sharing the wealth, spreading the wealth, would appear to be a true definition of democracy. But what they did, what they was accused, Allende, of being a socialist. You know, this socialist thing has become more and more, you know, widely known, you know, as of late. The funny part about that is that the Republicans are accusing the Democrats of bringing in socialism and therefore destroying their democracy. On the other side, the Democrats have taken Donald Trump and labeled Donald Trump a fascist. So we got half of the picture right, or we have half of the picture so far established by their own account. By their own account, we have half of the picture. The Democrats, black and brown people, along the way, led by the black and brown intellectuals, have labeled Donald Trump a fascist. And so this last election, where they had given us an old man and a colored girl who actually can, you know, go in and out of blackness and whenever she fits. You know, she can label herself biracial 1 minute. If the conversation comes down to some biracial thing that made national headlines and there's been a debate, she can take part in that debate. Next minute, she can say that she's a woman of color. Okay? And then, push come to shove, she can say that she's a black woman. So there's been instances where they referred to her as all three after she had become chosen to be Biden's running mate. You know, one station is saying first, well, when they had won, put it like this, when they had won. And so you hear some one station saying the first black female vice president. Then another station said the first woman of color female vice president. Then they say the first biracial woman, female, whatever president, vice president. So this had come down to this Machiavellian tactic of create a boogeyman, someone who is a threat, someone who the people can learn to fear. And so this had to come down to Trump. And the Democrats have been making it seem that there never once was a moment of time in history that a person like Donald Trump had set foot in the White House, which is a bald-faced lie, especially when it comes to black people. Now, Donald Trump has said on one or two occasions that he has done more for black people than any other president in the history of elections, which would obviously include Obama. I haven't heard anybody challenge that. I haven't heard any of the Negro intellectuals challenge him or debate him on that, so there must be some type of validity to it. So how could Donald Trump be a fascist and at the same time did more for black people than any other president in history? Think about that for a second. How could Donald Trump be labeled a fascist and yet did more for black people than any other president? We'll let the viewers or the listeners decide or try to figure that one out. And if you can get around to the answer, push the one on your phone, and you can not only teach us how so, and also those who, others who may be listening. If Donald Trump is fascist, then what does that make the Democrats? The Republicans, as I said, have been labeling the Democrats socialists who are in the process of destroying the country. So there's a heck of a dilemma let alone trying to figure it out. You know what I'm saying? But you have what's called a wolf in sheep's clothing. You have individuals who are out in the open about their feelings about black and brown people. In some instances, they may refer to the poorer whites as poor whites or trailer park trash or these terminologies they use to refer to poor whites. you know, the vagabond, the serfs, and whatnot. The Democrats and the Republicans shared the same portfolio, even though a jackass looks nothing like an elephant, besides the fact that they both walk on four legs. Okay? Other than that, they have nothing in common. But when you look at the portfolio of a Joe Biden, and you look at the portfolio of a Donald Trump, the question is, are there any differences? They're both capitalists. They both believe in the free market. They both believe in free enterprise, unfettered free enterprise. Now, Joe Biden may give the appearance of, let's say, what is the word I'm looking for here? Sort of curtailing certain things. But other than that, their portfolios are the same. If you look at Donald Trump's son, if you look at Joe Biden, been accused of this relationship with Putin, Donald Trump and Putin, and you turn around, what do you see? You see Hunter Biden and his relationship with the Russians. So if the Russians, in some instances, have been labeled fascist or totalitarian or authoritarian, then how is it that proponents of democracy able to do business deals with them? Now, the joke is either on the people, okay, or they could be terribly misguided, or they're one and the same who practice the same free market capitalism, which is no more nor less than unfettered capitalism, which means this type of capitalism that creates poverty. The type of capitalism that has, although it has this beautiful wording and ethics and so forth, and I can't even say the word, it starts with an M, it's no more nor less than on paper. But this type of unfettered capitalism, they don't know anything about what's fair or what not. Even in war, their psychology is what? Might makes right. I once saw where another definition of war, where it says it's not about who's right, but it's about who's left. See, and so the question is that democracy? Do democracies practice a war on other nations with that type of mentality? For instance, the present situation that's going on in Palestine, the cousins, Israelis of the Americans, which is basically a combination of several things. But in a nutshell, some see it as a war against Islam, where the Judeo-Christian faction, which has been teaming up for years and years and years, on one end. The other end of that spectrum would be the system of white supremacy operating under various slogans, subtle terms, or subtle messages. The Arabs or Arab people are not considered to be white. They're considered to be non-whites. So here you have two groups of whites who have joined forces, or one group of whites who have been in a physical battle and their cousins have been financially supporting them, not only financially, but through weaponry, you know, the various, you know, components that one would use to take another country to war to annihilate them. And, of course, the third thing, how you can look at that, is just another part of the mission to carry out genocide against what would be considered non-whites who are the majority population. And in that vein, the ideology or the philosophy of depopulation. something that had come from some European who had even been around the world. And yet he could draw the conclusion he lived in the late 18th, early 19th century, and he could somehow draw the conclusion that the planet was threatened to be overpopulated. And so the things that he spoke of that could check this population boom, from what I can remember, would be war, and I think famine. You know, so this is no coincidence. But do democracies carry out that type of behavior? You know, they said Hitler had practiced genocide against the white Jewish population of Germany. And so they looked at that as a quintessential example of fascism, that it was had nothing to do with democracy at all, and that Mussolini and the Japanese had taken the side of the Germans, whereas the Americans, the Anglo-American establishment, had joined forces. The Anglo-American establishment is just, the word Anglo is pretty much the same as the word as England. You know, they're pretty much the same thing. So the Brits and the Americans who had been joined by the Russians. And that is strange because, as I said, that the side that they referred to as the evil axis had become buddies with them like almost overnight. And that their buddies who they had been fighting with, the Russians, had become the enemy overnight, which led to the Cold War. Right. Now, how do we explain that? As an explanation of everything, we go back to the point of order. As an explanation of everything, right? We know why it gets cold. We know why it gets hot, right? And we know why one can catch a fever. We know why one stomach hurts. We know why a woman has a menstruation cycle. All these are explained. So how will we be able to explain that? As a matter of fact, Alan Dulles, who had been pretty much like the earliest or among the earliest chiefs of what had become the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor from which the CIA had come out of. And out of his own mouth, he had went told the officials there, you know, those who represented, you know, the so-called American establishment and military heads and whatnot, and had told them that they were fighting on the wrong side. Now, here we are. We're told that the Russians and the Brits and the Americans are the Allied forces, and they're fighting to stop the evil Hitler and his buddy Mussolini and Hirohito, the leader of the Japanese. And overnight, again, they had swapped sides. So Alan Dulles had told them, we're fighting the wrong enemies. Now here you are, supposedly be allies with the Russians, and another man is seeing it from a different perspective. Now, what made the Italians and the Germans fascists and the Russians not fascists? And then overnight, the Italians and the Germans stopped becoming fascists and they had become part of the UN. You know, they had become part of the structure. And the Italians, to this day, is one of the countries who have also taken a interest in Mother Africa with their corporations and companies. So they have the same portfolios, America, Britain, Italy, Germany, and so forth. And so now the Russians and the Chinese are referred to as communists. And they've joined forces along with the Iranians. Several decades ago, both the Iranian countries and the Iraqi countries had their leaders overthrown, assassinated, by this so-called democracy. So here's the question again. Do democracies have foreign leaders assassinated? How could one who is the leader claim to be a democracy when the people had chosen the person who they wanted to be their leader? And so all these things are interconnected. We understand that those of us who set ourselves politicized, those of us who set ourselves to taking a good look, beyond all of the smoke screen, all the bullshit, all the window dressing, all the rhetoric, all the neatly packaged news stories and the you know, the Anderson Coopers of the world, 360 and Wolf Blitzers, you know, the Situation Room, and all these other people, Sean Hannity on Fox, old crazy-ass Lauren Ingram on Fox, MSNBC, the little colored girl, Joy Reid, and all the rest of them, Rachel Maddow, whatever her name is, all of them are part of the structure, are part of the corporate control media, whose job as the media wing of the state is to misguide, to confuse even at times, to outwardly appear to be media adversaries. You hear on CNN these talking heads will take clips from somebody who appeared on Fox or show a clip of Sean Hannity or Ingram and put them on and show that they're getting fake news and they're lying about this. And then you will see Fox take clips from CNN and, you know, and vice versa. You know, so why is all of that transpiring? And as I said, that the Democrats and all of those who have followed the line have taken Trump and made him the bad guy. That this election that passed was to save this country, was to save this democracy. That they couldn't allow Donald Trump to get back in office, that he was destroying this democracy. And as I said, the Democrats, the Republicans, have accused the Democrats of being socialists, threatening to destroy this democracy. I want to give another example of whether or not democracy overthrow democratically elected presidents, where the people have spoken. In Venezuela, the great Hugo Chavez had won the election in his country, and he had won again, and he had been what was referred to as the people's champ. And before you know it, this government, through their spooks, the CIA, being on the ground and looking for those who were disenchanted with Chavez and sought to overthrow his government. Meanwhile, on the various news media, whether they're Fox or CNN, both had used the same label term towards Chavez, the Chavez regime. It is standard protocol on the part of all of these news anchor people that sit at the big desk to use certain terminologies. As I've said, the state actor label. Anyone who doesn't fall in line with the Anglo-American establishment's agenda will either be referred to as a regime or a non-state actor.
And yet, these nine state actors had, again, resorted to the same process that we here in the snakes are told is the hallmark of democracy, the right to vote. And we touched on Gaddafi last week, who had one of the most prosperous governments in place before his assassination. And so here is Chavez. Chavez, once he had become elected, he had done the same thing that Allende had done. Nationalized the foreign companies. And so the people could share in the wealth that had been accumulated, you know. And Venezuela is one of the countries that had been in, I believe, the top five in oil. And Chavez's Venezuela had become a member of what they call OPEC. That is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And so America has had some type of hard-on for OPEC countries for the longest. And so if you take a map and you look at these OPEC countries, and what do you see? Now we can get around to answering the question that, you know, or two that has been posed. The dependence of the American economy or the American superstructure on oil, which meant that this government had to have set up some type of apparatus or some type of international diplomacy or policy, what they refer to as interests abroad, which is no more, no less than a no-holds-barred mindset using Machiavellian principles or even Hegelian principles, posing on one side to be your friend, or on the other side they're looking for a soft spot to stick the knife in your back. And so with Venezuela, they had failed, and this coup that they had pulled had failed, and it was because of the people. It is because of the people that Chavez survived this coup on him. You know, compliments of the CIA, their spooks and their agents, which had been in Venezuela, this minority class of wealthy elites. And again, this is the same shit. It's the same thing. It is a small group of elites who no longer would have these privileges that they had been having over the average Venezuelan. And so Chavez has started leveling the playing field. And because of this, this so-called democracy attempted to overthrow another democracy. People who had the same right to vote that they tell us every 4 years to elect the chief executive officer of this United States corporation. So it could be no way possible that if we had been living in a democracy, that they would, that democracy would resort to overthrowing another democracy. And there are a lot of people in this country who have sort of, some of us have reawakened, and some of us have woke up, who have become disenchanted with the state. We know that black and brown people, what's left of the indigenous people, have been having a time of it under this democracy. Now, the cases of police terror that have been transpiring here in America on a usual basis due to an inherent contradiction, due to what is virtually an irreconcilable relationship between the state and black people in particular. The inheritors of the slavery machine out from underneath physical slaves, the ideological descendants of the capitalists who earned everything for free, or shall I say, the capitalists who enslaved another group that didn't earn anything. And so the ideological descendants today, just under a more sophisticated system referred to as an hourly wage, but the power structure is still intact. Recently, there was a gathering of original Black Panther Party members from the Black Panther Party that began in 1966 in Oakland, California. One of the elders, a warrior queen, when speaking to the people who had attended one of the nights, which lasted, for a weekend, and she had said that, "Y'all, nothing has changed." Now, what exactly did she mean by that? Because some of us have become so socialized, so socially engineered, that because of the election of a black president, that they would be sort of confused or mystified even as to what she meant by nothing has changed. There would be those who would even attempt to challenge her statement. Those who would take a look at the civil rights achievements or civil rights accomplishments or the accomplishments by civil rights activists in the 50s and the 60s. But the understanding of the Black Panther Party was so way different, or I'm trying to think of this other term is not coming to mind, but the thought process of the Black Panther Party had placed them on a different plane from these other groups, because they were looking at the conditions of the black collective, not some black person who had been selected and trotted out in front of the people to give the perception of change. Yes, we all understand that during the 50s and the 60s, there could have never been selected a black president due to the racial climate. But yet, as the Hells Angels Motor Bike Club had said after Obama was selected president, they even had T-shirts made that simply said, "It's still the White House," in reference to this black president. There were those, all the euphoria. I had even heard a young brother or some folks online or social media was talking about, we're going to paint the White House black, and all the rhetoric. the entertainment. And of course, there are elders who lived to see the election of a black president before they gone home back to where they come from. You know, before they close their eyes for good, you know, and become part of the higher realm. But the structure is still intact. The ideological framework is still intact, which therefore means that nothing has changed. That the people hadn't gotten control of the power. That the power structure has simply created a situation where, as Machiavelli had informed the prince, that every now and again, give them something to make them feel like they belong, which is one of the Machiavellian principles, in order to keep his subjects pacified, you know, under his rule of thumb, using various strategies. So that was no more nor less the case. Even as the chief executive officer, what Obama did was tapped into the same strategy that George Bush Sr. had used to get elected as president, where he simply had taken the black criminal and used the black criminal to appeal to white middle class women, which is how Obama was able to get a lot of white women from suburbia to cross over and vote for him. And this may be painstaking for some of us. Again, you know, we understand, you know, the history thing and whatnot, and we ain't tripping off that. But it is what it is. Black capitalism is just as dangerous as white capitalism. Right, we make no difference if a black person was selling a pair of Versace shoes for $1,000 or $1,500, or a white person was selling it for $1,500, or a brown person was selling it for $1,500, or the Arab was selling it for $1,500, or the yellow man was selling them for $1,500, or the red man was selling them for $1,500. It will make no difference if the gas prices had gone up underneath a black president, a brown president, a red president, and so forth. It will make no difference if the milk, bread, the meat has gone skyrocket high, whether it's a black president, brown, red, and so forth. The system is still intact. White male patriarchal rule, which has become so sophisticated that a lot of us may become confused. The outward appearance of beings always disguise those which lurks behind. So what we're doing is peeling back the layers. So police terror, what we understand is the arm of the state, the first line of defense in keeping the unwanted in the position that they collectively find themselves. This was the genius of the Black Panther Party, to properly assess the role of the police. And the terrible thing about that is that black people, we can say the system because we feel the brunt of the system every day. So instinctually, we have an idea. But collectively, historically, black people have never been informed, even in moderation, the true nature and role of what the police means to the capitalist system. And this is why I do the inherent contradictions on the whims and aspirations of a few. whose ambitions has nothing to do with the general masses of the people beyond getting them to be consumers, you know, gross consumerism, which, you know, fills their coffers exponentially, you know, and then take that money and put it into things such as gunpowder, bullets, and technology for weaponry, such as the technology that they're working on to prevent any case that a police officer's weapon has been gotten from him and turned on him to use against him, to where they're working on the technology with the officer's handprints or his fingerprints. We each have a unique fingerprint. And they're trying to take the technology and make the handle of the weapon sensitive to that officer's fingerprints, and therefore the gun would not recognize anybody else's fingerprints but his. And so this is what they do. This is what these fascists do. Now, would those who live in a democracy practice that type of thinking? Or would those who live in a democracy who have accumulated huge amounts of wealth perhaps would see to it that they will put a huge dent in homelessness and so forth, you know, if this is a democracy? You know, I've heard people say that this place in Brazil called the favela is one hardcore place, and that if you think you have it hard in America, then you ain't seen nothing until you went to favela in Brazil. And Brazil has a 80 million strong black population. This is the area, the Caribbean, the Latin America, if you will, where the first Africans were brought and turned into chattel property. And so we can look at the favela and see the basic system intact. You know, the displaced, the sons and daughters of the those who were forced into slavery, the holdovers of it. So therefore, it's really no different. You know, it is no different than looking in Southern Africa and what you see is what they refer to as the Bantustan during the so-called apartheid era. Apartheid is still alive and well and kicking, even though they trotted out his man in front of us and gave him a ticker tape parade by the name of Nelson Mandela. And again, this isn't personal. You know, we know this and understand as a historic fact. You know, there's the old saying that the majority rule. Well, in Southern Africa, this fictitious country called South Africa has about a 12% white minority population, but it controls the power. Now, how is that possible if the majority rules? How is that possible that the majority of the people in Southern Africa, who I guess, to my understanding, practice a democracy, has a democracy, and they can vote? But how is it that 100 people in the room, and of course we have to include the Indian population, who will be considered as coloreds. So a combination of that, now how is it possible that you have 100 people in the room and 84 of the people in that room is black and brown people, yet 12 people in the room can dominate the other 84. Now, we would sort of be out of our minds if we had to place a bet that 12 people versus 84 people in a tug of war to where the losers would be pulled into a pit of crocodiles. And that we'll have to be out of our minds pretty much to place our bet on those 12. Or in a fight, in a brawl, that those 12 would somehow whip to 84. So here's one of these exceptions to the rule, I guess, where that the majority rule doesn't fit. But how are they able to dominate the other 84? Because it is the power structure. It is a power relationship that the descendants of those who came in and took over Southern Africa to dominate the black and brown indigenous population there. And yet they claim to have a democracy. And yet the people there still find themselves in the same miserable conditions that they found themselves under apartheid. But the trick is to take a small crop of Africans, young, hardworking Africans, Africans who seek higher education, and turn them into a middle class, and then trot them out in front of the rest of the world and say, look, Southern Africa has changed. There is equality. There is a burgeoning black middle class in Southern Africa. And that is the trick. Now, in America, that would have been referred to as satellite intent during the days of W.E.B. Du Bois, William Edward Burghardt Du Bois. That would have been referred to as the talent intent. And this talent intent had a problem with another man. And this man's name was Marcus Mosiah Garvey. And Marcus Mosiah Garvey was trying to instruct the people of African descent who had been abused and used and disenfranchised and the unwanted, the outcast, to uplift themselves and become proud of who they are and their heritage and their history, and to establish themselves in a manner of economics, even in politics, in commerce, business, to establish their own institutions. And the talent intent, they opposed God. So why would they? Why would they not join forces with them and achieve something that the descendants of the Africans were forced into slavery to be able to have something, to uplift themselves out of conditions that they're in? And so the state had been grooming them to do what? To help the structure stay intact. Is that democracy or is it a sophisticated form of fascism? And so back to the police. This relationship, that has a combination of things. And some of us may find this rather amusing. This psychosocial, sexual, neurotic behavior on the part of the white man, which was the drive behind once black men had been lynched, that they would castrate these black males, you know, while they were hanging. So this hard-on for castrating black male genitalia, what was the reason for that? you know, the type of twisted sickness that would move a white man to castrate a black man who's being hung. And this same type of mentality that drove the Klan is the same type of mentality that had driven the police. And this is one of the cornerstones of police terror. Seeing the black man is not only as an enemy, but an enemy combatant to keep the structure intact. White male patriarchal rule, who in the vision or sight of a black man is seen as also a enemy in terms of a sexual position, a threat of white genetic annihilation. And this is embedded in their subconscious. There's one way we can look at what some of us refer to as police terror. There's others of us who refer to the police as the pigs. This is a term that derived as a result of a relationship between the black population in America and the police in the 60s. After the Black Panther Party had sized up and summed up the role of the police within society to serve and protect a particular class and race of people, as opposed to an unwanted population featuring its male population. And so the nasty treatment the police had been meting out to brothers in the 60s, the Black Panther Party sized that up as the equivalent of a pig in the pen. The nastiness of a pig in the pen. And so there are this brother who was good at our Emory Douglas had taken, drew a pig standing on his two hind legs and put a police uniform on the pig with a billy club and one of his hoops and a police hat on. And that is how that got popularized. The physical abuse, murder of black men. And this is why the Black Panther Party had developed a self-defense ideology, you know, from the outset. And so we see the same relationship here in 21st century America in maybe more sophisticated ways. The case of Ronald Green, for instance, who had been, once his car had come to a stop, had been dragged out of his car, and they beat him to death. Now, they could not see him as a brother, as their brother. They were not trying to see that. They were not trying to hear it. So they beat him to death and then tried to cover it up. And even in their own body cam footage. And the exposure that had been gone had become enough to have the state move to press charges. And in the state of Louisiana, there's this loophole that they use as qualified immunity, and perhaps across the country. Is that democracy or is that fascism? Here you have your own video footage, not some passersby or some person who happened to be walking by, whatever, in a car or whatever, right? And yet, these officers, as someone like to call them, we refer to as the pigs, you know, can ride off into the sunset. Now, what democracy does that? What democracy does that? You know, what democracy does that? And the police apparatus here, when you compare them to the police apparatus underneath Mussolini in Italy in the 30s and the 40s, the police apparatus underneath Hitler in the 30s and the 40s, you would see they're virtually one and the same. And the court system in Italy was set up in favor of the police. And this is the same operation in the judicial system has a relationship with the police. And this is why black people are having a hard time trying to get a conviction. We used to say back in the 80s, only we can catch them bastards on video or on film. And that moment came when Rodney King was stopped. And people were able to video him almost being beat to death. But when it came to the courts, and they put these four pigs in particularly on trial, and it was not guilty, and yet you see on video these same pigs beating the shit out of Rodney King. What more evidence do we need? And they proved us wrong. So we didn't need to catch them on video doing it, because there it was. So what happened? A rebellion. And what became of that? A white boy named Reginald Denny, you know, who was passing by innocent and got dragged out of his car. I believe that's in Florence, you know. And they had taken that and said, look what the niggas did. How could you beat up an innocent white man who had nothing to do with those four pigs? You see, and here we are with George Floyd. And so what did they say? Well, at some point, we better give these niggas a victory. But they retried these four pigs. And what did they do? They called themselves trying to please both sides. They were not going to give up all four of them. Two was found guilty, two was found not guilty. That was a concession that they handed out to the Negro intellectuals. Is that democracy or is that fascism? Alton Sterling, his execution in Baton Rouge. No justice. Philando Castile, executed right in front of his own child in Queens after the pig asked him, did he have a weapon in the car? And he told this pig who requested to see his license. And he told this pig, I'm reaching for my license. And he shot that brother anyway. Oscar Grant in Oakland, BART subway station. Young people coming home, I think, from a party or a gathering. And the BART pigs harassed him, pulled him off, got him down against the wall, handcuffed Oscar Grant face down. And what did he do? Shot Oscar Grant. Executed him. And we can go on and on and on. One case after the next. Now tell me, in what democracy do its police do such things? We could never see that as democracy. Let alone trying to get convictions with the obvious. I mean, with the obvious. Breonna Taylor's execution, one after the next. Jaheim McMillan in Gulfport, Mississippi. Shot in the back of the head at a Family Dollar. One after the next. So what democracy does that? Where's the justice? Where is it? There should be some consistency if this is a democracy. Mussolini, the corporation, the judicial system, and the police. Hitler, his judicial system, and the SS, which, by the way, is featured in the Star Wars movies as the stormtroopers. Who do Hitler's bidding? I mean, yeah, you might well call him Hitler. Who does Darth Vader's bidding in the Star Wars movies? And here you have the rebellion, the rebels, fighting against the evil empire led by the emperor himself and Darth Vader, his main man, on his left-hand side. It would appear to me that in those movies, the rebels were on the right side of history, fighting against futuristic fascism, dominating the universe. So we believe we've made a case for fascism, which has become a sophisticated form, the most sophisticated form of fascism to date, right here in America. And the people have tolerated it. Black people have grown so disillusioned, but there's something in the air that gives us hope. There's something in the air that certain segments of the black population is starting to grab hold of. And there's different forces that are working to prevent that. The murder of Chairman Fred Hampton Sr., who had a tremendous impact on the street tribes of Chicago, and how the different vice lord sets had started forming together in their different cadres. And I believe the spokesman for the Keystone Nation or the Gangsta Disciples. And they timed the assassination of Chairman Fred and the takedown of Bobby Gore, who was his spokesperson for the Vice Locals. And it wasn't a coincidence that all of this had taken place around the same time. Only fascists do things like that. Desperate people do desperate things in desperate times. Because of the potential threats galvanizing its strength under one banner to end the fascist treatment of people of African descent who were the descendants of those who were forced into slavery once they were brought over here and treated as property. So we hope that we've got our point across tonight. It's a democracy of fascism. You decide. We'll see, or we'll be back next week, same black time, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, in defense of the people's radio, in defense of the people, brought to you by People's Political Party. I'm one of your hosts, Chairman Nat Turner, and our Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, other co-host, and our engineer on the ones and twos, who I like to refer to as assault technician. Sister Amino Shawn, our Minister of Communication. So we sell power to the people, black power to black people specifically, and the whole rule, we out of here.
Peace. I'm called Professor X, the Overseer. In the early 1900s, a brother set out on voyage. His mission, black nationalism. His oath, freedom or death. In the 60s, brothers like Stokely Carmichael, H. Rap Brown, the mission, black nationalism. The oath, freedom or death. In the 90s, the mission, black nationalism. The messengers, X-Clan. The movement, Black Watch. The oath, freedom or death. By the way,
freedom or death, you shall all be moved. Vanguard, this is protected by the red, the black, and the green with the key.
Abracadabra, a la baby professor, all hail funky lesson, sweet tongue grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in a cosmos where no time and space do exist, vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a logical, mythological. They couldn't comprehend when I brought the word, a thick called verb, a black still nerve, teaching those actors and actresses who write a couple lines on what black is. Really? Then they label me a sin when a brother just speaks what's within. I guess I'm blacker than the shadow in the darkest alley that they're always scared to go in. Boo! I wear boots and beads, bags and braids, stick and scroll, raise the shade, walk in the light of the moon, but I've never been a Batman. African, call it black man. Brother, extract the African steps in your movement. Enhance for improvement. Grand funk, I knew a home for the phrase. Funk and lesson, the pathway.
Ready or not, yeah.
And cornbread, how can you act this? I exist on a plane where the jar is my brain. I'm living to retrieve cells and ten on my stick. Pitch a bigger native lick.